Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Blinders, on this week's show, the Golden Globes return to TV. Don't Worry, Darling hits theaters, and director Baz Luhrmann joins the show to discuss Elvis's home video launch. Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 229 of Real Blend, a podcast that hopes that every Oscar contender moving forward includes as much silly Brad Pitt as we saw in the Babylon trailer. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor at Cinema Blend, and if you haven't seen that trailer, please go out and see it sometime soon. It looks like Damien is turning it up to 12 as he tries to capture the roaring 20s of Hollywood. I'm sure we'll be discussing that as we go through
the awards. He is definitely rushing and not dragging.
And also, Real Blend guest Damien Chazelle.
That's true. Yes.
If
we hope, returning Real Blend guest Damien Chazelle.
If you missed that interview, please seek it out because he was awesome. It was like early on in the pandemic. He had a Netflix show that was out. And it was just like, we were just getting him in his element. It was like, it was just hit him at home. And like,
those those early pandemic episodes are weird.
Yeah.
We got Michael Shannon just like in his house.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's in his office.
Shooting the breeze.
Barry Sonnenfeld.
Really Sonnenfeld yeah. that we had to edit.
Sonnenfeld was a trip.
All right. On this week's show, believe it or not, the Golden Globes are going to return to television. And that was a surprising announcement that dropped on the day that we are recording. So we're going to dive into
were
that.
Were you surprised?
I really was. Yeah. I really thought that.
How about we discuss it in the segment where we're going to discuss that?
We should talk about it on the show.
There we
I
go.
Guess
so. Don't Worry, Darling is going to hit theaters.
And, Kevin, what do you think of that movie?
Two of the guys have seen it.
Oh, let me tell you.
And we have a really exciting interview in Baz Luhrmann, who is going to be joining us to talk about Elvis on behalf of the home video launch. You may recall we didn't get Baz the first time through. Because this up-and-comer, Tom Hanks, wanted some time on the show. And so if you haven't checked out Tom Hanks on the Real Blend podcast, please go back and redo that. And then we were thrilled to have Baz circle back around and join us as the home video segment was coming to pass. So Elvis is coming. You can see it's on HBO Max right now. I've seen it available for streaming, and I think you'll be able to own it. And, oh, I showed the guys this before. I have multiple. I have this cover, and I have this cover.
Ooh.
And I have... that's it. Just those two. Just those two covers.
But I really thought that was going to be the beginning of like a long list of covers.
Nope, I thought he was going to bring out one of a jumpsuit. And he was like, and I have this jumpsuit.
The 4K cover is the best one, though.
Yeah, I love the 4K cover.
Tom is still wearing the jumpsuit with the glued on side.
I thought you were kidding.
Let me welcome the boys to the show. Jake Hamilton and his dog Daenerys chiming in from Chicago. Fox 32 in Chicago. Hello, Jakey. How are you?
Hi, buddy.
Kevin McCarthy is in Fox 5 in Washington, D.C., and was recently in Chicago to hang out with Jake. Hi, Kev.
Good to see y'all. Yeah, I was in Chicago for Bros. Jake and I went and saw Bros in Amsterdam together. And then, so now I'm back and talking to you guys as always.
Ready
love
to
you guys.
Do a show. And then Gabe Kovach is holding down the fort with a bit of bronchitis under the weather, but doing well. How are you, Gabe?
I'm good. Bronchitis sounds a lot worse than it is, but I'm good.
Yes.
Speaking of bros, though, Sean, does that remind you of anything that we should let our audience know? Speaking of bros, things they can look forward to?
There is an interview that's in the can. When is it going to run? Do we know?
Next week, yeah, for release.
Next week sometime? Okay, so Nicholas Stoller, the director of Bros, who also has helmed Forgetting Sarah Marshall and two Neighbors films, and has now tackled Bros, is joined by producer and comedian extraordinaire Judd Apatow, a return guest to the Real Blend podcast. And the two of them are going to be joining us to discuss Bros and their comedic careers. We got into the state of rom-coms and how they tend to treat them. We talked a lot about Heavyweights, which was unexpected.
We went on a real heavyweight tangent.
Tony Perkis.
Yes. The draw of working with Billy Eichner. And so we were really thrilled to get those guys to come on to Real Blend. And you guys will be able to hear that next week as Bros gets a little bit closer to release. So let's go through the housekeeping stuff in terms of if you're watching us on YouTube, thank you so much. Make sure you hit like and subscribe. Turn on your notifications. We are inching closer to 10,000 subscribers. And I see your comments about my OCD and a nice round number. And I appreciate you. That's very kind of you to get to think about me in that way. So let's push to 10,000, and then sit there for a while so we don't mess it up. We have, of course, we're available all the places you get your audio podcast needs met, and then the premium, the Real Blend Premium, which drops every Monday, an ad-free version of the show, a newsletter that's coming to you guys this week. And then, what was I going to say? Oh, and then a bonus episode, episode that drops on Monday where we normally play some type of really fun game. I think this week we're going to be doing the mailbag. To answer a bunch of questions.
And you get, I don't think you said this, you also get ad-free versions of this very show right here, this main show.
True. Yes, very true. So there's a lot of reasons to sign up for premium, but essentially it's the looser, you know, more casual, Real Blend's having a sleepover, and we're just going to stay up all night, talk about fun things vibe. So that's the type of thing you get out of premium. And I advise everybody to go down and check it out. And if you're doing it right now, we thank you in advance for supporting us in that way. We love all you guys equally. As mentioned, Baz Luhrmann is going to be joining the show. He is stopping by to talk about Elvis, and he's just the nicest guy. He's Baz cracks me up because he doesn't view himself as a filmmaker, but he currently, Elvis is his highest grossing film in his career. So he's clearly connecting with larger audiences. But I loved in this conversation, he gets really candid about how he felt Elvis was going to play in certain markets, like how it would do better in America, and particularly the Midwest or the South, the Deep South. But then that there are like international markets where Elvis is extremely popular, and he thought that the movie would do really well there. He talked a bit about the 4-hour version cut that he could do. He talked about the support they got from the Presley family in Graceland. So a really great conversation that I am delaying by telling you everything that's in it. So let's jump right to Baz Luhrmann as a guest on the Real Blend podcast, starting right now.
We so rarely get to talk with a filmmaker after the film has come out. And obviously this movie was incredibly successful. It was the most successful film of your entire career domestically. You don't make movies very often. So when they are successful, what does that do for you as a storyteller? And how did you feel, not just that really great, solid opening weekend, but how did you feel week for week when you saw those minimal drops between week 2 and week 3 and week 4? I mean, that's more telling than a big opening weekend.
You know what, you so right about that. And I will tell you that I'm still here. If anyone noticed, right? And what I mean is that, yes, it went out on HBO Max on the weekend. Yes, we're VOD working backwards. Yes, we had an opening weekend, remembering that my focus was how to get older audiences into the theater and find a young audience for Elvis. So, you know, and then a whole other journey starts. But to answer your question, I mean, knife's edge, you know, like there's a lot of, look, I've used this metaphor before, but it really is like, I've had kids, so it's a bit like having a baby, you know, there's a bit of flirting when the idea goes on, the foreplay, you know, then the deed happens and whoa, we're pregnant, you know, and that production. And then, you know, it's the birth. And, you know, if that goes technically right, you just want to make sure that the newborn isn't clubbed to death like a baby seal by, you know, those that might not want to see it see the light of day. And then it starts to grow up. Now, the birth moment is that opening weekend, because you're right. If we came out and it was like, oh, interesting film, but not enough box office just to get in the race, you know, that I wouldn't say the child is stillborn, right? But that's a difficult birth. But we had a really strong, clear birth. The question is it going to grow up? And as I speak to you now, because it's now gone on that journey, it's like that baby has grown up and and is beyond a teenager and is going off to college, it's got a relationship going on outside of me. Like, it's got nothing to do with me now. You know, I just gave birth. You know?
Interesting. I do want to drill down on a specific aspect of that and just get your impressions of how you might have predicted. Now, of course, no filmmaker really wants to predict success or failure. And as you say, you just sort of send it out into the world. But I find it really interesting that of your films, it's the highest grossing domestic. And if it did a little bit better worldwide, it would have topped Great Gatsby, which would have been your highest grossing film of all time. Did you think or predict that it would do better in the States just because of Elvis's popularity here? And as is reflected in your movie, he didn't necessarily get the exposure overseas that he wanted to have.
Mm. You know what? I would say good question, because actually my films have traditionally done better. Usually it's not just Gatsby. They've done better internationally than domestically. You know, Gatsby did really well. I mean, Leonardo, Jay-Z, the music we did, all that work. But the fact that Elvis did well in the US, I mean, there were areas where I thought we might have done a little more just because he didn't go there, you know, like it's amazing. Like, the number one expert on Elvis is comes from Scandinavia, you know, like he's number one expert, like above and beyond everybody else in the world. You know, the mayor of Tokyo at one stage put a statue up to Elvis. That's how loved he is in Japan. I mean, the recently assassinated Japanese prime minister, when he came to America, he only wanted to see the White House, and the only other thing he wanted to do was to go to Graceland. So I just sort of felt there's a cultural depth there. What I think is, though, is that it was enough, such a focus for us to get the older audience to come in to the theater. And then we gained through Austin the younger audience, you know? Mm. So I think I just wasn't able to be everywhere and do the same sort of intensity, and not just me, but the whole team all the time. But having said that, it's absolutely a living, breathing creature that's kind of beyond me, you know? It has its own life, you know?
You know, Baz, I was looking at your filmography, and one thing I really found interesting is after Strictly Ballroom, you shot everything 239 going forward in your career, essentially. Strictly Ballroom was 185, and that was, you know, 30 years ago today. And so I wanted to ask you one lessons that maybe you learned from that film that you still apply now in a film like Elvis, and two, because you went to 239 right after that film and everything you did, Romeo and Juliet forward, was 239. What was the decision there? Like, and was the 185 something that maybe you learned from, or that you wanted to kind of do differently going forward?
Wow, I thought you were going to say, I mean, look, I really wish you'd make a frigging 185, you know, ratioed film, for God's sake. I miss it.
No, I love 239 is more cinematic, I think.
You know what? You're right about that. Look, Dominic Alpine, who did with me Romeo and Juliet, Moulin Rouge. And he's done Don's done so many movies. You know, of course, now I made other movies with Mandy. But Don was always a thing about what was anamorphic, actually. We used to show, I mean, you're looking at someone who shot on film, you know. Okay.
I love that.
They exist, all right? still, but, you know, the thing about anamorphic, your words were right. Your right words, cinematic, you know. Now, what's curious, though, is the shape. I mean, one, I think about the theater. You know, I'm a man of the theater. But I have no problem. I will admit I've actually watched things on an iPhone 2 late at night on a streamer gone, you know. And that, they're remarkable, actually. I mean, an iPhone's reflectivity and the density of the screen and the color, sometimes a lot better than a television. But back to your aspect ratio question, I think televisions now, I'm looking at one right in the corner here, they tend to be that shape, you know? Mm-hmm. And so 235, yes, it's cinematic. And it used to be, oh my gosh, when they used to do modifications to back in the day, for your 235, back in those days, it was mind blowing, like for VHS and things.
Oh.
Like they'd actually
pan and scan.
Yes.
Yeah. And you know what? It'd be a two shot like this, and they'd be talking, and they'd pan arbitrarily. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't understand I had power to say, I am not doing that. You know, it was really hard to fight because in certain territories, they get a lot of money in the studios, you know. Pan and scan, man. Oh, unbelievable. You know, I mean, talk about so I think 2-3-5 is actually, one, you're right, it's inherently cinematic. Two, it happens to fit on all our screens now. I mean, this screen I'm on here, that 2-3-5 is going to sit really nicely. And even if it's on an airplane, one of those old ones, it's still only sort of cropped top and bottom. People are no longer doing that thing, you know? And also audiences. I mean, aspect ratio with audiences now. I mean, look, TikTok is up and down, you know? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So the way in which we actually receive the picture and the shape of the picture, I mean, back in the day, Gone with the Wind was like dead square.
You know? Like a 4:3, right? Essentially.
Exactly
like,
Right. You know, you think, how can a big movie be in that shape? But, you know.
Right. But Strictly Ballroom was interestingly 1.85, which I thought was really interesting.
That's right. It was a choice. And look, 1.85, I'll tell you what Don used to say to me. He's like, 1.85 is a really good for drama and a kiss, right? It's really good for a kiss. 2.35, amazing for epic. So in 2.35, if you're doing a kiss, where do you put the two heads? Do you lean it left? Do you lean it right? Do you long it one side? That kind of thing. Am I making sense? Am I getting too geeky here?
You fit in very well with this podcast.
I just asked you an aspect ratio question. This is literally the podcast.
This is what we do.
This stuff. Yeah.
Go and have a look at couples kissing and look at aspect ratio. And think about where do I, because, you know, in the end, there's got to be a profile of a kiss shot, right? Sure. You can over, you can come around or whatever. But in the end, it's got to be the poster, right? So there's the two heads. Like, where do they go in the aspect ratio, you know? In the middle, over here.
I love that.
Cool. Yep.
I love it. Baz, a lot of people are, rightfully so, talking about Austin for an Oscar nomination, and everyone here knows how long that Oscar campaign can be. I mean, we're like 6 or 7 months from the Oscars, but it's already starting to ramp up because of Venice and the Toronto Film Festival. What advice do you have for him on how to endure what can be a really long and exhausting few months of shaking hands and kissing babies?
Right. You're absolutely right. Look, back in the day, around Moulin Rouge, I realized, having done an election campaign, actually, for the Prime Minister of Australia.
Wow.
Right?
Oh, wow.
And understanding what that was, I realized, you know, I used to think like, oh, isn't there a fit? Not really. And my philosophy about awards in general is the following. Winning one, great. You know, I just signed off on I Belong in Outside the Box, so I'm good with that. Listen, my wife's got 4, you know, breakfast time, there they come, bang, bang, bang. Like, hey, check it out, you know. she really doesn't care, but I mean, she does care. It's a great honor. But what awards do is it throws light on the movie. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that. And so doing the campaign and getting out there and communicating the movie is almost more important than actually who wins in the end. I mean, of course, it's wonderful. You win the Gong, fantastic, you know, very honored. But what's really important is kind of the journey. And your point is a very good one. I was talking to Oscar the other night and saying, look, this isn't about, like, you've got to participate. And you are right. Like, what you don't see on the outside. I mean, growing up in a small country town, I was, you know, the Oscars, oh my God, the Oscars are on, you know, like, oh, would I ever see that one day? But growing up in a tiny country, I mean, but what we don't see on the outside is chicken dinner number 335 at the something or other that triggers a something or other, you know? So when you said shaking hands, kissing babies, and essentially like in an election campaign, actually what you're really doing is re-communicating the film, and you're really wanting like to get attention on it, get audiences in, and get, you know, get the constituency to really consider it, you know? And you know what, like winning, that's one thing, but do I think that Austin Butler, who so many, and understandably, so many naysayers went, how can that guy play Elvis Presley, who gave 2 years of his life, day and night? I did not know Austin was from Anaheim until a significant amount of time after I met him. Like, he was already down Elvis Road, you know? And when the pandemic came, he doubled down on his karate. He doubled down on his voice. He doubled down on the work. Like, I just think I don't think he slept much. Mm-hmm. He just lived as Elvis. Like I never met him that he didn't have a piece of Elvis in his ears or watching one film or looking for an obscure piece. Like, the level of devotion. And I've been around devoted artists of every kind, was just off the charts. So at the very least, he should be acknowledged, you know.
Acknowledged. 100%.
Yeah, he became 100%. Him.
Yeah.
Baz, we don't get to talk about the end of the film often during a press junket. We want to protect as much as we can. But now with the film coming to home video, I want to ask you about a very specific moment, which was a full gut punch to me, which is when you cut to the only moment of actual footage of Elvis.
Yeah.
And it is, even through everything that we've been watching up to that point, to see him, to see actually him, and you're struck by his age and how he looks. And it's it was heart-wrenching, you know. It was like, I can't believe that this man, with everything that happened to him and how he looks this way. I wanted to just talk to you about your creative choice to cut to him in that moment, and what you had to do to almost set that up so that the transition could happen.
There's two parts to that. It's a great question, because you're right. I you know, despite what people might think, I actually do lots and lots of labor on writing. Then I shoot, I'm even running during shooting, and then I'm running in post. Like, I'm still trying to perfect the construct of it, because my films are layered, you know? And but the end, you know? Like, you know, and it's interesting because the scene, it relates to another scene, the scene in the back of the limousine with Priscilla. I always knew they should have this scene in, and honestly, I probably wrote that 2 days before we did it. I was just laughing about it with Austin, saying, what about, you know, like when they have the breakup and he sings, you know, and because I was trying to find it. And I say that because I imagined at one point, maybe Elvis, the end of it was like Elvis towards the end of his life, he had the Lisa Marie. He's just fly around. Mm-hmm. And the pilot would say, where do we go? He said, just keep flying around. Don't leave us. Like a sort of bird in a cage. I kind of wanted that image, you know, he was just going to, you know, because of that lovely speech about, you know, bird without wings doesn't land, right. You know, right. He lands, but wants to fly. But then, we had to do Unchained Melody. It was always like, it must, for a long time, we had to say, and then let's coda it with Unchained Melody. Now, that reel you see where Elvis actually is at the end, you know, and you cut to him young, like the real Elvis cuts in, and you see, I had a reel that I used to have like 6 years ago when I'd say, talk about the movie or show it to Tom Hanks or show it in the studio. And John O. Redman, who was one of the editors of my editing team, you know, Matt Biller and John Redman, had cut that reel, and it's exactly how it was. And right, and we went like, you've got to see Elvis. And I can't remember how it happened. We were in a sort of session, you're like, well, do we, like where? And your wonderful way of saying it, the gut punch idea, which was do it at the moment. Musically, you were there, and you're like, well, you know, there's only, what's so extraordinary about that footage is that even people who are so not Elvis fans, and there were a lot of them back then, I would show that footage, and as corrupted as the body was, the voice soars.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That moment when he looks at the audience and smiles like a little boy, like, am I doing good? Huh?
Right, yeah. Right.
That's real. And so what you understand is that the real issue with Elvis, and this is what the Colonel sort of argues is, like, and there are very few icons like this, is that in the end, the love between him and the audience and back, just nothing can compare. And I think you still see it in that footage. And everyone I showed that footage to who had not seen it were moved by it. They were sort of, you know, I'm talking about folk who would be like, oh, Elvis, you know, the big guy in the white suit, bit of a joke, isn't he? See that? And they're incredibly moved. So we felt we had to get it in, and finding the moment, that's what it was all about.
It humanizes the myth, essentially.
Yeah. And it was right, because, like, honestly, he can barely stand up. He cannot get 3 words together. You know, blah, 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 trying to make jokes that aren't working. But when he sings, and he's going to be dead in a few weeks, when he sings, he may sing the best he ever sang in his life.
Right.
Mm. I mean, did he know? I don't know. But that's an extraordinary piece of footage.
Oh, I'm glad you included
and by the way, I want to tell you, there was a lot of amongst the controlling groups, and I understand this, oh, we don't like to put that footage out there. We really don't like to have that footage out there, you know?
That makes sense. I understand that. They're protective. But you know, it was the right choice.
See it, you know what? When you see it, though, the beauty of the soul cuts through the physical degradation. That's what I think. I think that was the choice. Yeah.
Agreed.
You know, Baz, was that something I brought up to you at the TV junket that I wanted to highlight here, because our show is a filmmaking podcast, because I think this is a really interesting thing. As I've rewatched the film, I've even thought about this even more, which is sweat and hair continuity. We talked about this at the junket, and you were talking about how this is an important part of your filmmaking process. But as I'm rewatching Elvis, the continuity is perfect in terms of every time we cut back to him, the hair and the sweat and everything. But I don't think people realize how hard that is to keep right. Can you tell our audience kind of like why that's important to you, and maybe what did you learn it on earlier films of yours? Because to me, that's one of the most interesting character aspects. His hair and the way he sweats is a character all in itself.
You're 1,000% right in terms of Elvis. Like, he really thought about it. He thought about, like, he practiced the way he moved his hair. In the 50s, he wore three kinds of different hair wax and practiced moving his hair as he moved, right? Which wax here and that, right? So there's that. The sweating thing, which the Colonel hated, you know, like, he, that was part of his kind of have to get in the spirit. Like, he didn't practice steps. He sort of did them. But let me tell you something. In the early days, my continuity was appalling. Like, I think there was a website dedicated to Baz Luhrmann's horrendous continuity, right? Like, in Strictly back in the day, in the world, yeah. Like, and in the early films, like certainly Strictly Ballroom, I didn't really mind it because I was sort of aping old Hollywood movies, and so it was more important the kind of gestalt of the vibe as to whether it was exact. You know, there's a few cheats in there, and it was early filmmaking for me, and I was trying to discover the language. But on this, no way, no way. And the reason is this. I was copying real footage. So I was already handed a kind of chalice that said, you'll be compared to. I mean, you know it. You see on TikTok, they've got Elvis doing If I Can Dream. They've got Austin, you know.
Thank you
for his devotion and our camera angles. It's a match. Now, I'll tell you how much energy we put into that. There was a lot of language on the set, you know. And, you know, I had an amazing hair and makeup team. And, you know, you cut and they get in there and get amongst it. Sometimes even I would freak with Austin's hair because hair is a big deal for me.
Yeah, it's a huge part of the movie.
So much so, this will nail it for you, that Austin goes and gets hats made for everybody. And I used to say, like, we've got it. You know, like, there's going to be explosions, there's going to be a car. And I was like, okay, ready? And I was like, how are we? And I used to yell out, the hair has spoken. That meant we're ready to shoot. And I got hats made for everybody and said, TCB at the front and the back. If there's a picture of his hair on the back of the cap, it said, the hair has spoken. So essentially, everybody was waiting for the hair to speak.
That's incredible.
That's fantastic.
Olivia told me during the thing, she was complimenting just the detail of the extras in the Christmas special, of how much you paid attention to the way they sat, where their hands were, you know, how, like, that's the level of detail you were putting into these scenes.
You know, a funny thing about that, by the way, Polly Bennett, got a shout out to her. She's part of our team. She does act and movement, unbelievable.
She worked on Rami Malek, right?
With Remy. And she did Austin movement, but also she worked with us on all the extras and all that. But we all absolutely detailed nuts. I'll tell you something great. I just released, I think on TikTok or something, a tiny snippet from the comeback of us doing Trying to Get Back to You, which is not in the movie. I just had to compress and make choices. But someone said, oh my God, I can't believe they've got that weird, geeky, like, you know, 12-year-old kid with the round glasses in there even, you know, which we do, right? And he only appears like in one shot in the comeback. But there's some, must have been the son of this sort of round-faced kids who's sitting right near the amplifier of a producer or something. He said, you sneak in the producer. So yes, the answer is absolutely, because we call it train spotting, meaning, is this a train spotting shot? Mm-hmm. And that means to, like, getting it right on the Milton Berle show, like Austin and I, like, just getting it so that it truly matched, just like, you know, focal lengths, quality and density, black and white, and then Austin and the movement, you know. I mean, that set, you see colorized pictures of the set, but we did the research and the set in that Milton Berle is the real color of the set, you know? So it meant a lot. We could not let the fans down and then go like, oh, near enough is good enough. Cause near enough when it comes to train spotting is not good enough.
Right.
You know?
Baz, we've been told we have time for one more, so I'm going to cut you loose on this. There has been a lot of talk about a longer cut of this film out there. Tom Hanks told us that there's a ton that didn't make it into the final film. I had heard that we're about to get like a series episodic version of Australia. So I'm curious, does that mean that like one day there will be a usage of this extra Elvis footage? Like, would it be a longer form of the movie? Would it be an episodic version of the story? Like, are you going to do anything with that footage?
Jake, it's a really good question, because what's going on with Australia is it's not just like Australia plus a few extra scenes. It's literally a different creature. It's called Faraway Downs. I've done some really great new music with it, with an Indigenous, young Indigenous performers. It, to me, it's like variations. It's like Debussy does variations on Sati. You know, it's the same piece, same subject, same materials, but it's different. When they say there's a four-hour version, that doesn't mean that there's 4 hours of finished visual effects mix and everything sitting on a shelf, and I just have to kind
not of yet.
Move it out of the punnet. Exactly. Not yet. Having said that, and I have to tread carefully, because honestly, I'm still just, you know, I'm here hanging out with you guys, still talking about the film, and it's, you know, it's still in theaters. And like, you know, and my BID. But what I will say is this: not now, not you know, not even maybe next year, but I know that, and it's not 4 hours, because that's an assembly, you know, but is there a more evolved variation on this version of the film in the very far future? Yes, I think we live in a world now, and that's why I went for it with the Faraway Downs. I think we live in a world now where a theatrical experience can exist. Mm-hmm. You know, we live in a world where like look at music, you know, like, you know, look at TikTok, like, you know, something comes out, someone mashes it with something else, they do an overlay, you know, it's almost like chaos theory. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think that you're foolish not to open your heart to the possibility of taking one set of material, playing it one way for one portal, and then looking at a variation on that material for another way of telling the story. So sure. I only care about storytelling. I do care about bringing people into the theater. I passionately believe that human beings want to sit with other strangers in a dark room and commune over a story, no matter what's going on your television, you know, or your iPhone, you know. But I'm also open to what can we do on an iPhone, you know. Is that did you cut me loose in the right way, or did I go too far?
No, that was perfect.
Listen, Baz, as you can tell, we would love to have you on all day.
And yeah, we have enormous, so many questions. Yeah,
we're
yeah.
enormous fans of you as a storyteller, and we just thank you so much for taking the time to come on Real Blend.
Well, I think one day you will regret saying you'd have me on all day. I think even all of you would tire of it. I know that. But listen, it's encouraging and it's uplifting that young guys like you really care about movies. The passion, that's really great. You know, so I can retire now. Good luck with it.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Naturally, we want to thank Baz Luhrmann for coming by the show. He is welcome back anytime. Terrific guest, and make sure you guys go see Elvis. I'm starting to see a couple of Oscar charts, and I'm seeing Austin Butler's name on there as high as like 2 or 3 in the best actor category. So that push could be really real.
It is.
I said out of Toronto that no one's going to beat Brendan Fraser, but I would love to see Austin Butler in the race, right? I mean, like, there's a lot of stuff that has to happen between now and then, but he seems like a really strong candidate.
Baz's comment about the nomination almost being more important than the win,
okay,
I thought was really interesting. Mm-hmm. Just about like bringing attention and bringing eyeballs to, you know, just to the film, which, you know, which is true. It's how it works.
Well, and I think if people stop to check that movie out and they realize that, like, he's legitimately, no pun intended, giving his sweat and tears to that performance, like, he leaves it all on the line to play Elvis at various stages of his life, which I think
what's his Oscar clip?
Oh God, I don't know.
Is it? I mean, one, like, there's a part of me that says like it should be him singing, but I also love the "You don't have a passport, you son of a bitch," like screaming at Tom Hanks.
Oh, interesting.
Behind the scenes.
Okay. I like the scene where he goes out on the like the baseball field.
Yes.
And he defies the.
Oh yeah.
He does the kick.
He does the dance. Yeah.
That's a good one. Yeah, because he's actually also giving also saying dialogue in that scene too before he starts the song, and like mm-hmm. yeah, and like, and the beauty of that scene is that the way they're eyeing he's eyeing the people around him, or people looking at him to say don't mess up. That scene's great. And then
I think they also in that scene before we move on, I love that scene because I think that's the first time I've only still only seen the film the one time where they first cut to like still images, like mm-hmm. actual still images of him on the stage. I think that was the first time they did that, and it matches beautifully.
Could that be a new premium game? Like saying, you know, this actor won for this role. What was their Oscar clip?
Ooh.
Oh, like literally what was their Oscar clip?
Yeah.
I like that.
We could remember that's kind of fun. You know. Didn't they use a terrible one for Rami Malek? Didn't they use like a
any clip from the movie?
Shows any clip.
First of all, I love Bohemian Rhapsody. You guys have so much random hate for that film. I don't understand that.
Remember,
Jake,
No, I wouldn't ever go as far as saying I liked it. It's the more and more I read about it, and I think it also just like it's one of those movies. Do you ever like walk out of a movie and you're like, okay, yeah, it's fine, but then like it kind of just blows up and has so much success where you're like, okay, screw this movie because it had success
all the time,
more deserving success than it deserved to have.
I
think that has my chip on the shoulder about, and also in regards to like I also feel like that role and Rami winning is a big part of the reason that Taron Egerton didn't get the love and accolades and respect that he deserved for Rocketman, which to me that performance in that film was 10 times anything that Bohemian Rhapsody put out. Anyway, we've discussed this in the past, but do you remember Sean, we talked with Ethan Hawke about his Oscar clip for Training Day.
Yes, we did.
And remember his quote was like, I didn't win, but it, like if the award went to who had the best Oscar clip that night, it would have been me.
Yes, I agree with that 100%. I want to look up who Rami Malek defeated in that category.
Also, another good scene for the Oscars for Austin could be the scene in the Ferris wheel with Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good one, too.
Great scene. Because like basically, if you look at that scene, like a metaphorically like a spider, almost like he catches him in his spider web and he's like not letting him go. And they're, you know, that scene kind of, and even the Ferris wheel kind of looks like a spider web a little bit as well. So.
All right. Well, while I'm doing this, I want you guys to sort of vamp about the latest footage from a friend of the show, Mike Flanagan. Mike Flanagan has a new film coming, a new series coming to Netflix, but I don't think he directed it. I think he's just executive producing it. He
directed two episodes. Yeah. So it's a little, it kind of reminds me of a little bit like, not in terms of like the tone, but like, remember when the second season of Haunting came out, Bly Manor?
Yeah.
And he was involved, but it wasn't quite a full-blown Flanagan production like Midnight Mass or the first season of Hill House.
I believe what he said after Hill House was, especially like, you know, episode 6 and such, I believe he was quoted roughly of saying like, that was a lot to do that, and he's much happier to like be a part of something and then have all these other great directors come in
sure.
and lend their voice to that. The project yeah. versus
yeah.
trying but to see everything from beginning to end.
But did he do all of the Midnight Mass?
I think Midnight Mass was definitely, I don't know if he did, but it was his baby. It was more his baby, I would say.
Let me double check.
That's what I'm saying. Like sometimes a project feels like it's his baby. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes there's a project that feels like he's involved with, but in collaboration with other people. And the second season of Haunting felt like a collaboration, and this one does as well.
He directed all 7 episodes of Midnight Mass.
Yeah, Midnight Mass felt like his baby.
Well, yeah, because that was just such a... Well,
listen, and honestly, like, things are just better when they're entirely his. Like, not that I'm not... I mean, obviously, sure. Obviously, this new show, I think, is going to be a lot of fun. I think the trailer is fantastic, but the fact that it's not, like, 100% Flanagan, it's, like, Flanagan with others... I'm hedging my excitement, I guess, a little bit, I would say.
And this is, I find it interesting that he's doing another title with the word midnight in it in general. But this is based on a Christopher Pike novel, right? And so the trailer really intrigued me. I mean, like, it looks fascinating. I like the idea of him dealing with a younger cast. I just saw him tweeting about how fascinating it was to work with a younger cast. Like, one thing I liked about Haunting of Hill House, I mean, aside from, like, you know, who's the actor who played Elliot Neet? Henry Thomas.
Yeah.
Aside from him in Hill House, I don't remember anyone super famous being part of that. And I just, you know, and I kind of
Carlo.
Yeah, Regina. But I mean, but there was no like super A-list actor. So when I watched this trailer, and I love Carlo Gugino, I'm just saying that in terms of like recognition, I liked seeing a new cast. Like I didn't really recognize a lot of the cast members, unless you guys did. I did not. But I found it interesting and refreshing that I wasn't going, oh, there's that actor, there's this actor. Yeah. I was just like immersed in the world. The trailer does a great job of setting up the idea of the story. And also, I just love, like, it kind of reminds me, again, this is a big jump, but the concept of Are You Afraid of the Dark was always a big thing for me. Like, kids
love
just sit,
that show.
Kids just sitting around just telling stories. And I know this is going to be a lot darker and a lot more, I'm assuming, R-rated. But just like a moment where they're around the table talking about things. I just love those types of films. I love or shows or ideas. And so I'm already intrigued by that in general. And then the concept of the lead character being sick and obviously going to this place and figuring out kind of what's going on there. I don't think there was one jump scare in the trailer that I thought was a little too obvious, which was the girl that was down the street.
Yes.
Yeah. And then she like jumps in into the frame.
Yep,
I'm like,
yep. I mean, I know.
It's kind of like that Ring Grudge era type of edit where like,
dude,
you know,
in that moment I was like, please do something original.
Yeah. I know.
Please do something original.
I thought the same thing. I think it was like outside, maybe it was on like a cul-de-sac or a street. And like, you see this girl all the way down at the end. And then literally I said the same thing, Sean. I was like, Mike, don't have her jump into the frame.
Yeah.
Just, you don't need to
and
do
she
it.
Did.
But she did. I also get the game. The game we're playing here is you're trying to hook people to watch it. Not everybody watches trailers the same way we do. And but yeah, I'm all in. I mean, Flanagan, I was telling you guys on Thread today, if people are hearing this and you have not gone back and listened, we had two amazing interviews with Flanagan. One of them was for Dr. Sleep, which was like a 2-hour interview that we did. We were all just like dying laughing weirdly for a film that is so incredibly dark. And then we had him for Midnight Mass.
Yeah.
And he was unbelievable. He's been a great guest on this show. And he's just a talented director. And we're not just saying that because he's been on the show. He's just a really talented filmmaker that happens to do our show sometimes. I love supporting him. I love his passion. And I also think it's cool that he's kind of fell into this Netflix area.
Yeah.
Like he kind of has an interesting career path. Cause if you think about Haunting of Hill House, which was kind of like his big, huge breakout, I would argue. And then, you know, got Dr. Sleep, and that was obviously a big success in terms of like people loving it and you know, people loving The Shining. But he's really kind of found a great niche for himself at Netflix. And I think they're really kind of giving him the opportunity to make the shows and things that he wants to do. And you can tell that it's not compromised. It's his vision, what it feels like. So I'm
bummed that the third Shining film, his Dick Halloran film, isn't going to happen.
Oh, for real? Is that?
Was that did King write a book for that?
No, he didn't write a book. King only wrote two Shining books, but apparently he had planned on doing a second film for him, a third film for the trilogy about Dick Halloran. And they apparently, the story just came out this week that they cited the financial disappointment of Dr. Sleep as the reason not to move forward. And apparently Flanagan came out and said they were like that close to it happening.
And it's such a bummer because like Dr. Sleep, obviously, I know we know it didn't do massive box office numbers, but everybody you talk to about that film either says one, that they were surprised that it was on the level of The Shining, or two, some people say they even liked it more than The Shining. And I'm like, I wouldn't go that far, but that film, you know, anybody who could handle the Nicholson switch out that he did with Henry Thomas from the side, like he did, that's just masterclass. Oh, last thing I want to mention is this Possum Kingdom, the song in the trailer for Midnight Club. Classic.
Good choice. So.
Not to rehash Dr. Sleep, but you mentioning the fact, would that movie have crushed if they just like called it The Shining 2, Dr. Sleep?
Honestly, probably.
Like, Dr. Sleep sounds like a Marvel movie.
It honestly does. And when I saw that movie slated originally, so I'm Jake and Sean are big Stephen King fans. I don't read his books regularly like those guys do, but I didn't know Dr. Sleep existed. Like I knew The Shining and I knew the story behind Kubrick and what he did and changed all the things. I don't think I knew he wrote a sequel. And so when that slate came out, I'm like, wait a second, is this like a DC version of Doctor Strange? I was thinking that. I was like,
I'd be curious if they ever discuss like calling it like Doctor Sleep,
The Shining, Story,
yeah, or something like that, The Shining Saga, or something like that to try. Because
they cut its legs out from underneath it by not putting out the full director's cut. It's a Batman Superman deal. Yeah.
And they were playing the game to its benefit to when you're experiencing the film. Before it came out, we didn't know how much of The Shining was going to be in Doctor Sleep.
Mm. Right. Yeah, so, true.
Let me ask you guys this. You did,
yeah, I did.
I'll ask you this. And this is going to be, this is the question that we might have to like think for a second, because, okay, in our world, for us, The Shining is a massive film. Do you think general audiences are as obsessed with that movie as we are that would go to see a sequel to The Shining?
Not as obsessed, but The Shining is ubiquitous, is what I would say.
I get it. It's transcended its pop culture. But like, do you think it's big enough to have drawn people had they called it The Shining 2?
Yes. But also keep in mind, they put it out in November. I think you call it a Shining sequel, you put it out in October. I think no matter what, people just flock to horror films, particularly in the fall, particularly in our the month of October. It doesn't matter what it is. If it's a horror movie coming out, people are in just that mood. They're ready to go. They're getting their pumpkin spice latte and they are ready to wear their flannel. They are ready to do it. And I think if they put it out the month before, and yes, I agree with you, call it The Shining : Dr. Sleep, then I think you've got a $30 million opening, as opposed to $30 million box office total. But I've got to, really quickly, I just sent you guys something. The great Mike Reyes of Cinema Blend just made a really great point that I'm going to sum up, which is basically Mike Flanagan has a great relationship with Netflix, obviously, and the new head of Warner Brothers Discovery has said that they are open for business, quote, in terms of licensing their product out. Why doesn't Netflix step in, take the license of the Shining films from Warner Brothers, let Flanagan continue the story he wants to make?
Oh.
I can't take credit for that. That is the great Mike Reyes who brought that up, which is it's a great point.
So you put Shining and Dr. Sleep on Netflix, and then you let him continue forward. I would say, though, after making Dr. Sleep, would you want to go again? I mean, that movie is so... I mean, he already did such a great job. He's great.
The idea for the prequel,
I will say this. The one thing I find interesting about Dr. Sleep, like we were talking about this earlier, it's like, in terms of the money it made at the box office, Jake, do you think the running time has something to do with it, too? Because most horror films, like hour 30, hour 40, wasn't this like 2:30?
Yeah, it was a long film, but we've also 90.
Not in a bad way. I'm just wondering if that you think that affected
someone. Yeah, definitely. I mean,
someone's on Fandango and they go.
You know, I still feel like I'll cut it loose on this. I had a guy come up to me at work the other day, say, "Oh, you were talking about Dr. Sleep. Like, is that movie actually good?" And I was like, "We've worked together for like the last 5 years. How have you not heard me talk about how good that movie?" So I still feel like I'm convincing people to watch this movie. That just their perception of a Shining sequel is that it would just be bad.
Yeah.
Sean, real quick, you didn't give your Midnight Club thoughts. I know we have to move on.
It reminds me a little bit of, and only because I'm in the middle of reading it, that Stephen King book, The Institute, because it's, again, a young cast. They're in one single location. They're there to, in this case of the Midnight Club, treat what looks to be cancer and other infections that these kids are facing. I got a vibe when they were talking about figuring out how to get over their ailments and potentially live forever. Like, does this have a vampire twist to it?
That
hit me.
He can't do that again, though, can he?
Sure.
I mean, who else lives forever? What other types of characters live forever besides vampires?
I don't know. I think it's vampires.
Oh, and it's also important to mention, like, you know, that trailer is out now, obviously. But I was wondering, do you think the Midnight Club will ever attend a midnight mass in the show?
Oh, interesting.
Well done.
Someone get that. I wasn't even making a joke. I'm like, he should go to Midnight Mass.
No, they probably might. Not.
But it looks good. We're all in and we love Flanagan. And come on back on the show, Mike. We'd love to have you here. So,
Mikey,
I was surprised to learn that the Golden Globes were returning to television.
As was I.
Because.
First, I've heard you guys say that.
Sean, I haven't heard you say that before.
It's the I kind of thought we were just going to be done with the Golden Globes and that they could, you know, potentially exist as one of these other award shows that announce their winners via press release, but that we didn't have the need for a televised celebration because the market is a bit oversaturated. And here's the point where we will point out that all three of us are members of the Critics' Choice Awards, and we hold a ceremony that, contending to be the replacement for the Golden Globes and wants to be the bellwether for the Oscars. But the return of the Golden Globes to NBC seems to suggest two different things. One, that they feel that they have addressed the lack of diversity in their membership, which was the boldest strike against them in terms of losing the support of NBC. So I would like to hear some different ways as to how they addressed those concerns, because I don't really know much about their membership in the push ever since then. And just it's a vote of confidence for a format that I thought was kind of dying, which is these televised awards programs, because all you see are the ratings going down for these telecasts time and time again, and the Oscars trying to figure out ways to stay relevant. And, you know, how many more of these do we necessarily need? So NBC bringing them back, while I guess it's, you know, a ratings play for them, I just didn't think we were going to go down this road again. Yes, Gabriel.
You mentioned like what they've done to address their membership. This is according to Deadline, who's discussing a story. It says that the organization has added 103 new voters to its ranks, and that the total Golden Globe Awards voting body is now 52% female, 51.5% racially and ethnically diverse, with 19.5% Latinx, 12% Asian, 10% Black, and 10% Middle Eastern, according to the HFPA. According
to them. They had, what, 87 voters, I believe, and it was like there was, yeah, I mean.
It was super exclusive. And
yeah, that information, again, that is a big change. Yeah. I mean, okay. I'll clarify. It's a change that is moving forward.
For sure. Well, in February of 2021, they also cite this to what you're getting at. In February 2021, it was revealed that they had zero Black members.
Right. And that's to your point of the numbers you just said, like they clearly have made a shift. But was it enough? Yeah.
My bigger question is, why do we need the Globes? Like, can either of you answer why we need the Globes?
Well,
go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead, Jay.
I've always felt like they were the more fun show to watch, if I'm being honest with you. And it's also, I know people who will watch the Globes and not the Oscars because the Globes are just a little tighter. They're not as associated with being as long and drawn out as the Oscars tend to be.
They're not self-serious.
Yes. And it seems, yeah, exactly. It just seems like a little bit more of a party than, you know, the Oscars. Is at this point, I think, a show for almost exclusively for movie fans. Mm-hmm. And I find more people in my newsroom that I talk to who are casual movie fans are more inclined to turn on the Globes because there is much more of this X factor of I just got to see what happens. I don't know. You know, they're drinking and, you know, the years of Ricky Gervais hosting. You wanted to hear what he was going to say. And there was just sort of like, well, I just got to see what the hell is going to happen. And that I don't think that the Oscars carry with it. Well, that same vibe.
I think after last year, they kind of do, but
you can't replicate. I mean, I don't think that's something they want to replicate. But that's like, I mean, that's not the sort of moment I'm talking about. I'm talking about like the, you know, the fun. You know, they always had like fun, you know, presenters and, you know, like the fun little bits with Jim Carrey running to the back because he's in television now. You know, there's just like just little moments that the Oscars haven't been able to grapple. They haven't been able to wrap their brain around why the Globes always felt like such a party and theirs felt like more of a formal black tie ceremony.
That's what I mean. Again, I don't know where people stand on this. I actually thought Ellen did a great job hosting the Oscars when she was like incorporating the audience and like, didn't she order pizzas to the audience? And they took
that selfie. She might have been the last good host. Yeah.
Remember when she like casually dropped Scorsese a script and was like, oh, how'd that get there?
Yeah, dude. I mean, and then the best Scorsese joke ever, which we've said on the show a million times, was Jon Stewart. And I'll never forget, he was hosting the Oscars and 3-6 Mafia won for Hustle and Flow, which is a phenomenal film by Craig Brewer, if you haven't seen it. And we had Craig Brewer on the show for Coming to America, too. But he comes back from the award after 3-6 Mafia win and he goes, 3-6 Mafia, one Oscar. Martin Scorsese, zero. And like, because he literally hadn't won anything yet. It was such a funny bit. It was so great.
All right, so I guess we're tuning in. I mean, listen, this is a show that will tune in to the Golden Globes. Yeah. And I will give them the credit for the fact that it seems that show works a little bit better because they are doing better at hosts. And I'll level criticism at our own show and that the Critics' Choice has not been able to land on the perfect host up to this point. And the Oscars is struggling to find a good host. But between the combination of either Ricky Gervais or when they do Tina and Amy, who I think work really well together as hosts for that show, That sets the tone. It sets for the lighter, sarcastic, we're going to take the piss out of the industry. And it works to that extent.
I will say this. And again, I know that Ricky Gervais is controversial and people have opinions on that. When I hear that he's hosting, I will tune in just to see what he's going to say. I mean, sure. I just can't, because the fact that he's like saying things to people who are in the room, again, I'm not condoning what he says, but there is something about that, a type of television where you go, I have no idea what this guy's going to say, because he actually probably doesn't care. And I want to see what he's going to say. That would make me tune in. That did. And Tina and Amy, same exact thing. Like, there's like a, to Jake's point, and Jake's not wrong. I think the argument that I was making about last year was with everything that happened at the Oscars last year, you know, that brought the show in a very different off the rails type of show than it had ever have been before. Which is interesting, because the way Jake was saying about the Golden Globes, which was like, you don't know what's going to happen. That was just, it just happened to fall into the Oscars' hands this year. But Jake's right. I mean, the Globes are, there's an edge to them that you don't find with the Oscars. And at the end of the day, I don't think any of us take the Globes seriously, because generally speaking, when you nominate the tourist, you're trying to get celebrities to show up at your show.
Again, that goes back to the controversy of them in general, and kind of like what that show was and how they were treating.
Do you think there are any members of the HFPA that like are dying on that hill? They're like, screw you guys, I love the tourist.
I did want to point out before we move on, because Sean, you kind of asked the central question of like, do we need the Golden Globes? But I think that this is not, I don't think this is necessarily the Golden Globes are back. This is the Golden Globes have another shot.
Isn't it a 1 year contract?
It's a 1 year contract. We don't know if the reforms they've made is enough for the people who, if people are going to show up, if the celebrities they want are going to show up. So that's going to be something. And we don't know what the audience is going to be. I think because this is 1 year, they're trying to, NBC is going to say, okay, you've made these moves, that's enough for us to sign this, but we need to see not only how the talent reacts, but how the audiences react, and that will dictate if the Golden Globes have any place on primetime.
Yeah. And remember, people who won the Globe last year, when they did it or whatever, I was online, people didn't even announce that they won it.
But I disagree, because I think there were some people that did, and I would go as far as saying I think there were probably a lot of people who probably really wanted to but didn't know how people. I think by the time the Globes come around in 4 months from now, there will have been some distance from the controversy. I mean, look, let's be honest. If you're in that Oscar race, you want to do as much as you can and win as much as you can leading up to it. So I think if the people that get nominated and they're in that Oscar race, they're going to show up to the Globes. I think they will be there.
And the Globes matter when it comes to the forward motion of your campaign.
Yes.
Like, and
there's
like,
no crossover in the voting body.
We don't generally like when it comes to the Globes, that I don't generally take them as seriously as I do with the Oscars. Like when you think of an Oscar, there's a prestige to it, but there is something to be said about what the Globe gives you. And on a momentum perspective, like that is a very
people
big
start
show.
Talking about you. Cause remember leading up to the Globes a few years back, we all thought that Gaga was going to be best actress for A Star Is Born. And then all of a sudden, Glenn Close wins. And Glenn Close went all the way to Oscar night and then didn't win. But that shifted the whole power dynamic of the award season when Glenn Close won best actress.
It also shifts the way the Oscar voters vote. Because if the Oscar voters see that this person wins, I mean, remember, anytime someone's winning an award leading up to the Oscars, I'm not saying people are biased, but it's in your mind. Like, go, Glenn Close won, Gaga won, this person won. And like, I could see somebody theoretically going, oh, Close had all these awards, let's give it to Coleman for the Oscar. Like, that's how ridiculous these things get, I would imagine.
I have a suggestion.
Yeah.
Chris Rock hosts the Golden Globes.
Oh my God, that is the greatest idea I've ever heard.
My God, if they could pull that off, because he already said that he was offered to host the Oscars, which is a brilliant move on their part to try to get him to do it, and then he said no. He said he equated it to returning to the scene of a crime.
I would pay like a pay-per-view price to watch Chris Rock host the Globes.
The Globes have one shot for a 1 year contract to put up a good rating, right?
And let him say whatever he wants.
Throw a bag at him, and
this is such a great idea. By the way, you're blowing my mind. It would be such a great idea.
Last thing on this news story, though, what do you guys think about the fact that it's going to be on a Tuesday and not a Sunday?
Oh, it is? I didn't even know that.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah. Oh, that's weird.
Maybe on a Tuesday.
That weird. Seems...
Yeah, that's weird.
Like I Wait, said, this you, is oh, NBC oh, is placing...
football.
NBC is placing a
football.
Super yeah,
But they always have.
Well, by the 12th...
Are we still in regular season?
No, we're in postseason by then. We're in postseason by then. But in, I mean, obviously NBC is a major factor with the NFL.
Right. You can't... Well, yeah, even I mean...
Even yeah. if football's not on your channel, it's a major factor.
Yeah, you don't want to go up against that.
If you're starting it on a if it's a Tuesday, that shit better start at 7 Eastern. You know? Like, don't be giving me late night on a weekday.
Well, it's this is the same.
I just picture you like on your like old Gran Torino porch and spitting into your mason jar saying, "Oh, you better start the Golden Globes at 6 o'clock."
Yeah, this is January. It's January 10th. So Tuesday rather than the traditional.
At what time?
Sunday. It doesn't say.
This is the age old argument about the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Which should be on a Saturday.
But yes. But it true. Probably won't start until what? At least 5 Pacific? They're in.
That's true. It'll be 8 to 11.
It'll be 8.
That's good.
But like, okay. I still don't. I mean, I get that Sunday is the football mecca day. But I mean, like, I've had this discussion with so many people over the years. Like, the fact that that's not on a Saturday is mind blowing.
Yeah.
Like that should be a Saturday night. Yeah. Everyone's
honestly,
home.
Every Super Bowl party I go to, there's always that. Well, particularly for us, because we have to get up so early for our jobs. There's always that hang up of like, just like one or two beers. And that's it. That's all. Yeah. That's all I can do.
They start that game early, though, luckily, like 6:30 or something, which is thankfully they do that. But still, it's ridiculous. But yeah, I think the Globes or the Oscars, this all like the Globes, particularly, that's a great Saturday night show.
Yeah. Could be.
That's a great like kickback Saturday night. I don't know.
All right. Well,
we'll see.
We're still going to get into reactions to Andor and the new movies opening this week. But let's take a quick moment, throw it to an ad break. And we are back. OK, so Andor is coming to Disney Plus. It's the latest Star Wars long form series. The first one that we have received since Obi-Wan Kenobi. Kind of fizzled a little bit, and I have much the same way that you two are tuning out on the Marvel shows in general. I have, you know, sort of checked out on Star Wars, and I'll watch them, but I'm not going into them with any kind of anticipation of like, oh, this is going to be terrific. So it blows me away to report that I, having watched the first 3 episodes of Andor, find this to be potentially the best thing that Star Wars has released since since Disney picked up Lucasfilm.
Damn.
Yeah, I was
like
really
counting movies,
like counting
Force
movies.
Awakens.
Damn. Yeah, I would say the only thing that comes close to beating it is the Force Awakens, because of how fun that is. And again, this is only after 3 episodes. This show could completely shit the bed between now and the end. But I really enjoy
optimism,
the fact,
folks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Obi-Wan really
and
sort of
or
tanks.
It could be good
or it could do
and or
for this reason. So I really like Diego Luna in the character. I liked him in Rogue One. I think it has a lot of the elements that made Rogue One really interesting. And Rogue One showed us a side of the rebellion that you hadn't seen all that often before, the really sort of gritty underground push by people who were tired of having the Empire's thumb pushing them down sort of thing. It starts with the how these seeds of rebellion are coming about and why the people are being persecuted by the Empire. It does a really great job of showing the dichotomy of the haves and have nots and the people in the Empire being fat and happy kind of thing and mm-hmm. almost primed to be taken down by a really disgruntled community. It shows us new areas of the galaxy, which I've been clamoring for, you know, new worlds, new places to explore. And the director, his name is Toby Haynes, I think is one of the first true Star Wars fanatics to step into the director's chair. Maybe Abrams. And, you know, Ryan's interpretation of Star Wars is up for debate, but I think that he's a fan in his own way. I think he's a fan of Star Wars for different reasons, but this guy, Toby Haynes, directed the first 3 episodes and has created a very tangible, and very lived in, interpretation of the universe, whether you are in the bright and shiny, glossy spaceships and headquarters and the Imperial Senate and all the different places that come with the wealth of Star Wars. And he's just as convincing when he drops you to the ground level where you're following Diego around. And he's trying to put together these small missions so that he can raise some money to get off. It has an element of that you saw in Solo, where like Han was hustling in order to trade different things in order to get to certain places. And then through the course of that story, he gets picked up and recognized by people who know that, like, oh, you have a lot of potential for the rebellion and we're going to sort of put you to work. And you know that it's leading towards Rogue One. So it's not like Star Wars has branched completely away from, hey, we're still telling you stories that are loosely connected to the Skywalker saga. We can't actually break fully away. But it's the first Star Wars thing in a really, really long time where I watched the first two episodes and I kept watching because I was legitimately intrigued and not, oh, I'm doing the junket and I just got to finish the next episode.
Interesting.
Through where we are. So I loved it. And Kev, I know you got to see the first episode. Am I overselling it?
No, I mean, I like what I've seen so far. And so, you know, one thing that's really interesting is, like, you know, we talk a lot about fatigue and like how much they're stretching out certain stories. So remember, like, you know, first of all, you have the original trilogy and then the saga continuing through episode 7, 8, 9, 1, 2, 3, et cetera. Rogue One was already a spinoff, right? Yeah. And then now we're going backwards again.
Yeah.
So it's like we were already one off from the original films with Rogue One. Then we're one off again from that. So
yes,
we're pretty deep into like spinoff territory here. And I think, you know, we all know they all die at the end of Rogue One. I mean, that is a thing that we've seen. And Rogue One still has probably one of the greatest Star Wars scenes of all time, which is the Vader moment. But in terms of knowing where that story is going, what I liked about this series so far in the first episode is, while I know that Diego Luna's character dies at the end of Rogue One, I'm still interested in how they got to the point of what they did at the beginning of Rogue One. So I'm actually fascinated by that because he is an interesting character and Diego is a phenomenal actor. And like, you know, he comes from an incredible body of work with Alfonso Cuarón, and like he's worked with so many phenomenal filmmakers, and he just understands character really well. He always has. So Andor, like it's interesting when you watch him perform, he's elevated the character. When you have a really great actor in a position like that, there's a humanity and a grounded nature that you bring to him, and like you're watching what I felt like was a drama about a character and his arc, right? But obviously there's Star Wars and all the world that brings. But knowing that he dies at the end of Rogue One, attempting to steal the Death Star plans, but like I just still liked and enjoyed spending time with him, knowing where he was going. It was kind of like Black Widow in a sense, where like we all knew Natasha died at the end of Endgame, but they still made it an intriguing story that built her character out more, at least in the first two acts of that film, even though I knew she died later on. So the first episode I thought was solid. Now, I want to be completely transparent here. I've seen Rogue One once. It was in theaters when it came out. Not seen it since, which is why I'm probably a little rusty on the specifics of the plot. So my interpretation of the first episode was based off of one viewing of Rogue One and one viewing of the episode. And I thought it was good.
Blade Runner vibe to it?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. I mean, there's no for sure. And also one of the things that we talk about with Rogue One, which was so cool, was the ground fighting, right? Like the fights on the ground. So I think a lot of what Andor seems to be, from what I've seen, is it's literally grounded, but also emotionally grounded in a way. So I'm interested to see where it goes. I love Diego Luna, but I'm also probably not the best person to give a recommendation for this because I haven't seen Rogue One more than once and I haven't seen more than one episode, but I liked what I watched so far. I liked it better than the first episodes of Obi-Wan.
I liked it better than Obi-Wan. I liked it better than Book of Boba Fett. You know, Mandalorian is still really special. I think
Mando's the best. See, to me, and again, I haven't seen the next two episodes of Andor.
Yeah.
Using your statement, I would argue that Mando's the best thing I've seen from a series perspective.
Okay.
But I still think Force Awakens is probably the best project I've seen that Disney has done with Star Wars. Jake, are you with me on that? Is Force Awakens the best thing Disney's done with Star Wars?
Here, you know, I was thinking about this the other day. I don't know if I'll have in my lifetime a theatrical experience that was as like a theatrical buildup and payoff that was as special as Force Awakens. I just don't know if that can ever be replicated. So
well, there's something about you as a kid seeing Phantom Menace, though.
Yeah, but I got to be honest. There's going into, I mean, Phantom Menace is just one of those things that like I was so excited about, but I also kind of like thought was like we were always told it was going to happen. Like we were always told Episode One was going to happen. Right. Episode Seven is a thing that none of us ever imagined would ever exist. Like Han, Leia, and Luke all being back together in a film. So the build up to that, and then it being as good as it was, that, you know, so my perception of whenever I speak about Force Awakens or rank it compared to other Star Wars titles post the Disney buy, it's skewed because there's such an X factor there of how special that movie and that experience was. It's just like Andor could be one of the best TV shows I've seen this year, and I really do hope it is. I had to miss the junket and the screenings because of a personal family thing, so I wasn't able to see it. I'll give you guys an update whenever I do. But it doesn't matter how good it is. There's no replicating that. I just have to be honest with myself in terms of like my feelings toward Force Awakens and why it has the edge, because there's just an X factor there that you can't replicate.
We will continue to track Andor as it goes,
and then place it in the ranking, Gabe.
I guess so. Yeah, Gabe, we're gonna do the tier list for that eventually.
Absolutely.
Good.
I think before then, though, we have She-Hulk, which ends soon. It's good. You guys should watch it. It's fun.
Oh, I'm watching it. That's gonna be a tough one.
You guys, it's okay if there are things on the tier list that aren't A's. I know that you really like putting Marvel stuff in A's, but it's okay. It's okay.
All right. Sidney Poitier documentary is coming to Apple TV, and Jake Hamilton managed to catch it because he did an interview with someone you might have heard of before, Oprah Winfrey. So, Jakey, why don't you tell us about Sidney, and also clue us in on how it's like interviewing Oprah.
Well, Kevin's done it before. Sean, have you? I'm not being a smartass. Have you interviewed Oprah before?
I did. I got her for The Butler.
Yes. Okay. So we all got her for The Butler. I think Kevin got her for Wrinkle in Time. I got her for Sidney because she is a producer on the film. She's a longtime friend of Sidney Poitier. Look, I'm going to be honest with you. I love this movie. I pressed play because for the junket because I knew I was going to be speaking with Oprah, and within 15 minutes I was like, I just want to, kind of like how you're describing Andor, I just want to watch this just because I'm fascinated. He had such a fascinating life long before he was ever the person that we all sort of grew up, didn't grow up watching his stuff because he was already established by the time I was a kid. But I mean, he's just such a fascinating man that also there's so many layers to him in terms of who he was personally that was fascinating to me. There was a moment in his life. He had done one film. He had a kid on the way. He needed the money. He was still a struggling actor, was offered a role that he didn't morally believe in. He felt like the character made choices that he didn't personally agree with. So he turned it down. And that, I think, is such a microcosm example of who he is. I mean, keep in mind the famous slap from In the Heat of the Night. You know, that it was originally just scripted to be the man slapping Sidney Poitier. And Peter Poitier came up with the idea to slap him back. And that was a huge deal at that time. You know, the movie he did with Tony Curtis, where he was like chained to Tony Curtis, you know, where they were both criminals escaping. You know, there are so many great examples of like following his career, but also you have to keep in mind of like the legacy of who this guy was in the period in which he was him, like in the late 60s, in the middle of like civil rights. He was the most popular actor in Hollywood.
Yep.
And making movies where him being a black man was a part of the plot. I mean, look, guess who's coming to dinner? Like that. I mean, he was massive. So the movie brings in all kind of A-listers who very much admit to being the products of the progress that Sidney made. You know, Denzel's in it and Spike Lee's in it. And Halle Berry's in it. Oprah's a big part of it. Mm-hmm. All talk about being where they're at because of, you know, following the footsteps of Sidney Poitier. But just following him on a personal level, it also, you know, shines light on the fact, and I appreciate this in the documentary, that he wasn't a perfect man. Mm-hmm. You know, he was married and had children when, you know, he fell for one of his co-stars. Like, you know, it doesn't, you know, it very much talks about the idol and the legend that he was in the industry, but it also shines light on him as a man, which I think is very important. I really appreciated it. It gave me an appreciation for someone I thought I knew, but I'm always down to learn more about him. It's a 2-hour documentary. I mean, if you're a fan of, you know, I wouldn't even say like, oh, if you're a fan of Sidney Poitier, because maybe people listening haven't seen a ton of his work. If you're a fan of this industry and the history of this industry and the legacy of watershed moments, I think you should watch it. And then I think it will make you want to retroactively go back and see some of his work either again or maybe for the first time.
Is there a moment where he rides a plane to Houston next to some fresh faced journalist who
that, you know what? Look, sometimes you got to leave the good stuff on the cutting room floor, man.
Yeah.
Sometimes you got to. Yeah. I once sat next to Sidney Poitier on a flight, which yielded one of my favorite celebrity photos I've ever taken, which was the trade off of me being quiet for 3 hours. And not bothering him so he could close his eyes.
That's awesome. All right. So the David Bowie film Moon Age Daydream is expanding wide. And I don't know if I've told you guys this at all, but I hate David Bowie. Like I'm so.
Wait, I'm sorry. What?
Yeah, I am not. Kevin, you're muted. I'm
we
not.
We are going to have a problem here.
That's OK.
No, wait. I genuinely don't think I've ever heard you say this. And I'm a little like. Like, mind blown
now. Yeah, we can't just
like
go
Life
past
on
that.
Mars is like a top 10 song.
Life on Mars and Space Oddity are probably two of the greatest songs ever written.
What do you mean you hate David Bowie?
I don't like any of his music.
Space Oddity?
That's what I mean is I don't like any
Life
of his
on
music.
Mars?
No. You can name titles all, right. all you want. I don't
I'm
going to
sing
like
it, Gabe. Get the rights.
I just feel like
dude, honestly, like that is that might be more shocking to me than you saying you don't like Lord of the Rings.
But David Bowie Lord of the Rings similar.
It is because David Bowie's not one sound. That's weird.
What I love about Bowie is he's cinematic. Like his music is so cinematic. Like mm-hmm. Space Oddity like plays like a film. Like it has arcs to it. It's a mate. Oh my god. Wait,
David
Sean.
Bowie always just feels like he has his head up his own ass. Like I don't have what? No interest in his music.
I think you just have you the have, wrong impression.
Are you sure that you're talking about the same David Bowie? David Bowie.
He's talking about a guy named David Bowie he went to high school with.
Yeah, I'm like, dude, I have never met anybody who doesn't like David Bowie.
No, and I never understood.
And you're
any
such
of
a
the
big
interest.
Music guy.
And Sean no, likes, I know, but like
Sean likes Bruce Springsteen. So what can I say?
Well, Sean, listen, I'm not trying to talk down or like, yo, like, dude, how can you not? I mean, there's things I like that or don't like that people love.
Sure,
but Bowie to me. I just feel like he's universal.
I think that's beautiful. I'm glad that you feel that way, but I honestly have zero
So go ahead and
interest.
Give me a review on the David Bowie documentary, Sean.
So I will never watch the David Bowie one, but it expands wide if anyone wants to check
it out. I'd like to see it.
Tyler Perry also has oh my God, the way that they describe it, they're like, it's a psychedelic ride through Bowie's mind. And I'm like,
sounds awesome.
Shoot me in the head before I sit through anything like that.
What?
The Jazzman's Blues is coming to Netflix. It's a Tyler Perry film. It seems like it's very different. For whatever Tyler Perry is doing, but I don't know a whole heck of a lot about it. It played at TIFF and got good to mixed reviews for him. So check that out. We want to put on everybody's radar that the Avatar re-release is happening in 3D and 4K.
Did you get the name of that movie right?
Avatar.
I don't think that's right.
No. What is it?
No.
That
joke went way over when we're all in my head.
Ferngully?
Yeah. Pocahontas.
But the movie that two of us have seen that I have not had a chance to yet is Don't Worry, Darling, a film that has received a lot of attention for its behind the scenes stuff. But we would like to focus primarily on the film itself. And I'll start with Jake. Jake, this is Olivia Wilde's second film, follow up to her Booksmart film and to her directorial debut in Booksmart, which was well received. And the trailer for this, I will say, was incredibly intriguing. I didn't know what they were going for. I've heard it described as a Stepford Wives sort of story, and it looked like a powerhouse showcase for Florence Pugh. So is it all of those things?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's Stepford Wives meets another movie I don't want to tell you, because if I tell you, then that kind of would ruin the movie for you.
Okay.
But what I am going to say is I liked this movie. You know, take away all of the crap that we don't really like to focus on this show. And honestly, forget the whatever percentage on Rotten Tomatoes. I thought it's beautifully made. It's gorgeously shot. The production value is astounding. I thought there's a collection of performances that really impressed. Florence Pugh, just effortlessly fantastic. I thought Harry Styles was really good in it. Olivia Wilde in a secondary part. Chris Pine has a really kind of like dark, mysterious, enigmatic role that like kind of kept me captivated. And here's what I'll say is that like the whole time I'm watching this movie, I'm wondering like, what the hell is going on? Like, I was always wanting to keep watching to find out what was going on. I really enjoyed this movie. I feel like this is going to be one of those movies that I'm defending 10 years from now, even though like I'm not going to go as far as saying I loved it. I'm not going to use the L word, but I feel like weirdly defensive of this movie because I feel like people have already made up their minds without having seen it based on factors that have nothing to do with the movie whatsoever. So I'm like weirdly dying on the hill for this movie, even though I'd give it like a 3.5 out of 5. Kevin,
I'm gonna chat you the other movie that I think it's referencing, and so you tell me if I'm right or wrong.
While Kevin, you
go ahead and.
That's not what I was going to say. No.
Okay. Interesting.
No, that's not it.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. But actually, yeah. That I want to see.
Yeah, I would too.
There were 7 films that Don't Worry, Darling reminded me of. I'm not going to say them all, but there's 7 movies that I could tell you right now that like, and that was one of the things.
But when you say there's one big one. I'm going to message you the one that I'm thinking of.
3 big ones.
Okay.
But is the one you're thinking of 2 words?
Would you recommend it?
Oh, so that's funny. That one is not even part of my 7.
Interesting.
No. The one that well, I think there goes it's that. Like, yeah, I think there's 3 films that it's very similar to.
Okay.
Well, 7 that I thought of. But
this is great audio for people. I just privately chatting
you what I want to think.
I like the film too. And again, we're a show that focuses on filmmaking and the process, so I'm thankful that we have an opportunity to actually speak about the movie versus the actual drama surrounding it. But Matthew Libatique, I want to point him out first because he just shot The Whale for Aronofsky. And he shot A Star Is Born and Venom in the same year, which I thought was interesting. really great DP. And to me, that's the star of the film. I mean, Florence Pugh's performance is outstanding. It is riveting. It is horrifying. It is engaging. She's unbelievable. But she always is, in my opinion, she's always great. It's like a Midsommar level type performance where it's really, 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 there's a lot of things that she can do that are scene chewing. There was a moment where she wraps her head in cellophane. Was that what that was, Jake? That scene, I think it's in the trailer. That scene took my breath away. It was shot and designed beautifully. I think what's interesting is the conversation we were just having. My biggest problem with the film is I kept going, oh, this reminds me of that, or reminds me of this, or it. Mm-hmm. And there are literal, the major one that I think the film reminds me of, which I won't say, there is literally a line of dialogue in Don't Worry, Darling, that is the exact line of dialogue from the movie that I'm referring to. So that's another whole nother interesting layer to it. I thought Harry Styles was solid. I also thought he was great in Dunkirk. So I think he's extremely talented, and I'm very happy to see what he's doing with his career. So I think it's interesting. Like I loved the film until kind of the ending. I thought the film is building up to a certain twist or reveal that I didn't think was on the level of what the buildup gave it. That makes sense. I think the film really works well until the reveal. This is not a spoiler to say there's a reveal. The trailer gives you an idea of a mystery. We don't know what's going on in this suburban neighborhood. What's happening? It's what's weird going on. And whatever that happens to be, I didn't find to be as intriguing as the build up to it. Okay. It was a little bit of a letdown. That being said, though, I'm with Jake at 3.5. 3.5 to 4 range, because I do think it's a solid film and you got to take out. I don't think it's as good as Booksmart. And I know they're two completely different movies. I think Booksmart is a better directed film. I really do. Weirdly enough, I would argue that the strongest points of this film are Florence and Matthew Libatique's cinematography. Mm. I don't think I think weirdly the direction is lacking slightly. And I think Olivia Wilde is a really good director. I mean, I think Booksmart was outstanding. I think that Don't Worry, Darling works. It actually has some really important things to say about control. Trying to control this perfect life that we think we should be living. Chris Pine, excellent. Olivia Wilde's actually really good in the movie. Obviously, we know she's a really good actor. And I do think that she is a really good director. I just think that this film, it's really, to me, is the build up to something that wasn't as impressive as I had hoped. And I think they're building up for so long that that reveal needs to hit. And it just didn't hit for me. But overall, I recommend it. Put the drama aside. I mean, there's been drama in cinema for decades.
Oh, of course.
It's just because social media has really kind of blown this one up. It just happened to make this film that it became bigger than the movie. But, you know, it's a film that works. I think it's worth seeing for the shots and Florence's performance. She's outstanding in it. And it's really well made. So I'm with Jake. It's like I like the film. I don't love it, but I weirdly feel like I have to have an asterisk when I say it to people. I'm like, I actually kind of like this movie, because there, again, like Jake said, there's an inherent element of negativity already towards it without even knowing what the movie is about or what it's going to be like. And I think, you know, it's really hard to sit down and separate that. But if you can, try to, because the movie that's being made for you on the screen is so different and separate from the drama that we're seeing out in the world that I think you have to be able to separate those two.
OK, our blend game this week is dedicated to John Boyega, who has a film in theaters or on streaming called Breaking. I never know what
it was. It had a theatrical release for a few weeks. It might still be lingering in theaters, but now you can get it on demand. So okay. Like if you go on your iTunes or whatever, you can. I don't know if it's a rental or a purchase, but it is available in your homes through on demand services.
Also, Boyega is in The Woman King and is terrific.
Phenomenal.
As, good. The king of the kingdom that is defended by the Agoge. So he's having a good month necessarily. But when we go back and pick our favorite John Boyega movies, I'm going to say mine, and then you guys can tell me if you agree. I mean, my choice is Force Awakens.
Yeah.
Is that everyone else's choice?
Yeah.
Mine is actually Attack the Block.
Oh, is it? Good. All right. So we'll come back to Kevin in a second. I will bring up Force Awakens and rave about it for this reason. I never thought that we would find a movie that captured the thrill and the excitement and the whimsy and the sense of creativity that came with seeing Star Wars for the first time. And okay, so people are going to make fun of it and say, well, that's because they just made Star Wars again. They made A New Hope, but yeah. there's more to it than that. Because the cast has to work. Right.
They did it with new characters.
The cast has to work. It has to have a new polish to it, of which JJ does a very good job of aping in this instance, Lucas, that he's usually sort of copying from Spielberg every once in a while. And I loved John Boyega's character, Finn, in The Force Awakens specifically. Now, I'll argue that I think his character gets short shrifted over the rest of the trilogy, and I think he's completely mishandled because the idea of a stormtrooper rebelling against his conditioning to become a stormtrooper is a fascinating idea, and I feel like they needed to do a lot more with that, and it almost makes me wonder what direction that they were planning on going with him because of the way that he's used over the course of the rest of the films. But he's great. He's great. I mean, I love, you can go all the way back to him being the first shot in the trailer, essentially, of him, you know, popping
into frame.
Yep. I mean, that just sets the tone for what's coming in that movie. And that movie's a perfectly calculated, although it didn't come out in summer, but a perfectly calculated sort of summer blockbuster ride. It pushes all the right buttons. It delivers everything that it needs to be. And Boyega being a big part of that, his chemistry with Daisy Ridley is terrific. When he and Daisy and Oscar Isaac are together, they do form a trilogy or a trio that is as fun, while not quite as iconic, you know, as the Han, Luke, and Leia dynamic, which each of them playing different bits kind of thing. And I just think Boyega was terrific in it. And he got to wield a lightsaber. And I know that that was incredibly cool for him. And one of the coolest things was watching him do the reaction video when he saw the trailer for the first time.
When his family, right?
That he was holding his lightsaber. So that was really, really cool. So,
wasn't he with like family and friends or something in that video?
Yeah, they were sitting on a couch.
Was so cool.
Watching the trailer for the first time. So I love him. I love Finn in this movie. I think he's great. And so that's my choice. The Force Awakens. Jakey also chose it. Jake, what else do you have to add?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much more to add because you said it perfectly. I mean, I also loved the dynamic between him and Harrison Ford. They all they basically get to spend the last act together. And it says a lot that an actor can do something that makes Han Solo even better. But like, I feel like he brought a lot out of Harrison Ford and out of Han Solo and kind of gave him the opportunity to do some things with Han that we really hadn't seen before, obviously we ended up losing him. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's made all the more tragic by the fact that you're right. They completely didn't know what to do with the character of Finn in Last Jedi and in Rise of Skywalker, to the point where like they kind of sent him on aimless side missions. And I'm not going to get into the Last Jedi debate, but he's just a part of why Force Awakens works as anyone else in that movie, as opposed to in the other ones. It basically just becomes the Kylo Ren and Rey story. Mm-hmm. And it's a shame, but I thought it was brilliant. His dynamic with the new cast members, as well as holding his own with Harrison, just really says a lot. And it's a shame what happened, but I just genuinely love him in that, and obviously love that film.
Kev, you are not wrong by choosing Attack the Block.
Oh, I love Attack the Block. That's a great choice.
We're supposed to get a sequel, right?
It's coming.
Yeah. Attack the Blocks.
it's coming. Yeah, with Joe Cornish directing it. So,
Force Awakens is the film of the two that I would prefer to watch, even though I love Attack the Block. Mm-hmm. But I have to give perspective on again, this is a personal choice, right? A personal reason. So when I first watched Attack the Block, it was 10, 11 years ago. I didn't know who John Boyega was, right? Mm-hmm. So you know that feeling when you watch a film and you realize you're watching a star?
Yeah.
Like you're watching somebody who's about to blow up. Like, I don't know. There's something about the last time this happened to me was the kid who plays Eddie Munson in Stranger Things. Yeah. Joseph Quinn. Right. Mm-hmm. I remember watching those episodes. Didn't know who he was. And I was looking at the screen going, this guy is going to be big. Like this guy is he's electrifying on screen. And I just remember first of all, Attack the Block is just awesome in its style and its execution. And Joe Cornish directed it. And I think it's Stephen Price is one of his first scores, the guy who ended up scoring Gravity. And I just remember watching it, loving the vibe, loving the energy of the characters. I mean, he plays a character named Moses, who's, he's the lead in the film. And I believe it's Boyega's first movie.
I think he was like 18 or something.
Yeah. And so I think it's interesting because I've interviewed Boyega so many times over the years now for all three Star Wars films. And we just got him for Breaking and we got him for Woman King. And he's really, really grown up so much. And like, it's almost like he's like past that Attack the Block phase. Like he's in a very different space where he's very adamant about making important films now, films that are important to him, like Breaking, telling that story, or Woman King telling that story. He's very, very prominent in that world of like, I want to bring these stories to the forefront that I think are important. And I love that he's doing that because Star Wars gave him a platform that was bigger than and larger than life. Right. And I think what's funny about Force Awakens was going into it when they cast him, I was like, oh, hell yes. I loved him in Attack the Block.
Yeah.
I'm all in. And not only just obviously with Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher and everybody returning, but there was something that I had a level of excitement just based on that performance from Attack the Block. And I just remember digging that film. It was kind of like, I don't know if this is the right way to put it, but it kind of reminded me of like a modern day Guy Ritchie. And I'm not saying the tone of Attack the Block and Guy Ritchie's movies are the same,
but
there was a freshness to it. There was a spark to it. It was new. It felt like, I don't know, it was something. Attack the Block had its own vibe.
Well, it did something no film had done before.
Right. It spoke in a way where I was like, do you remember seeing like Guy Ritchie's movies for the first time? And you go, oh, I dig the way these characters talk. I dig the environment.
Yeah.
And I think Joe Cornish did something different with Attack the Block, but it was similar in a way that it was a vibe.
Has Cornish caught done on anything to it, and I was since like, then?
He did that kids movie about the kid.
It would be King.
Yeah. He did that.
Did he?
Yeah. Interesting. That's Joe Cornish, I believe.
Okay.
But anyway, so. I think that Attack the Block is my choice only because it was my introduction to Boyega, and it's the movie I always think about when I think of him. I know Star Wars and Finn are probably like obviously his most iconic, but Attack the Block is that one that I always go to. I'm like, that movie, and it's also a great movie to recommend to people.
Absolutely,
if you've never seen it, you go, hey, watch this movie called Attack the Block. It's freaking awesome.
Yep.
And then generally everybody who watches it goes, yes, that was awesome.
I'm really glad. One of the cool things I feel like about there being a sequel is that it will introduce the original to people who've never seen it. They'll be like,
and the original didn't do well, I don't think. I was reading that it didn't do well at the box office. It's one of those movies that kind of found movie fan audiences.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, Attack the Block kind of fell into the film Twitter circle of like,
remember that great shot of him?
This out.
Walking or no, running in slow motion with like the monsters chasing. Wow, that's such a cool shot,
dude. And the monster, like the effects in that film,
the glowing teeth.
It's a low budget movie.
Yeah.
And like what Cornish did with the effects and like the world building, it felt like a large production. And this was like a, you know, I don't know what the budget was on it, but it definitely wasn't Star Wars.
It's not far off from what like Edgar Wright did with like Shaun of the Dead.
Right. Sure. You know, sure. That Edgar Wright's probably another great example of kind of where I was going with that Guy Ritchie comment was like, there's just like a, when you watch Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, there's a vibe that Edgar brings to it. That's like fresh and like the editing and again, very different, but think about the first time you saw Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah.
You get Aronofsky's vibe. You get that voice, you get that. So like, it was like, I just think greatest about that moment.
Thank you.
Yeah. But I think about Joe Cornish and I just think about like, oh, Attack the Block was just like a new vibe. It was cool. It was like, it was fresh. It was unique. It felt cool and it felt like it was made with genuine passion of like kids who just wanted to make an awesome movie. Well, so
Rachel Ho agrees with you and she said Attack the Block.
So good.
Harry Lichtman and John Palmer went with Finn in Star Wars. Now they just threw out a blanket Finn in Star Wars.
Yeah, so come on. We don't play that game.
How we play the game here. Dino Paolo.
It's favorite performance. It's movie or performance for,
Don't bail them out, Gabe.
Well, no, it is. It's a character that he plays. Performance is Finn.
Dino Paolo and Zach Abdul-Baki said Detroit, Catherine Bigelow's film.
He's fantastic in Detroit.
Oh, I forgot about Detroit. He was great in that.
Seth picked Breaking, and then
he's great in Breaking.
Maniac Mike says Red, White, and Blue from the Small Axe series, McQueen films that he made. So thank you very much, everyone, who participated in this week's John Boyega blend game.
And speaking of John Boyega, the Woman King, if you haven't heard our interview with Gina Prince
Bythewood.
Do you always want to say no? I want to keep this in because do you always want to put an L in her name?
Yes,
I do.
We had this discussion on Premium where I was like, I always want to call her Blythewood, but it's Bythewood.
Yeah, that's Bythewood. Where I get caught up. I'm like, yeah, I think I'm combining Bly Manor for some weird reason with because her last name because she obviously Danner. Did Love and Basketball.
Maybe Blythe so. Danner.
Yeah.
Anyway, it is a fantastic interview. It is a fantastic.
Yeah, it's very good.
Two of them.
So go check that out. Okay, so for next week, Gabe, I need some clarification here because we are playing a blend game called hashtag double feature blend.
Let
us know your pick via email at realblend@cinemablend.com or using the hashtag double feature blend. But give me some parameters for this.
Parameters, favorite double feature. So, yeah. So what movies you want to watch? And this doesn't have to be like, pour your heart out. Love story about a double feature. Although if you have a great story about, I went to, to a drive-in theater and I saw this double feature. This is the favorite double feature I ever saw. I love that. But I also think we can treat this as like pitching a double feature that you really like. We're getting into the fall season, which is for me is double feature season.
Mm-hmm.
When I do a lot of sitting down watching particularly horror movies, but I think moving forward, we'll come back to this and we'll give it more specific parameters of like horror double feature or thriller double feature or comedy double, you know, things like that. So this is just a general double feature. I would love to hear, folks at home, are you guys, your favorite double feature experience? But if you don't have one and you just want to pitch a double feature that you love, just send us two movies that you think are make for a great back-to-back viewing.
I know Jake and I have one that we both love, and I don't know if it's cheating because it was released as a double feature.
We'll find out next week.
Jake, come on. What movie did you, what is the one movie you saw in a theater that was a double feature?
But for a moment I thought you were saying that like we saw it together and I was like, did we?
No.
Okay, I know you're talking about.
But it was, I will say it was the first time I ever interviewed this person who has now been on our show multiple times.
Who could it possibly be?
I mean, we've had multiple
What double
on
feature
the show
was released
times.
As one movie that someone put up. Before at least four times.
Before we move on to the closing, I want to double back to point out that this is who Rami Malek beat in the Best Actor category.
This is
I forgot about that.
Well, one of them Bradley Cooper?
Bradley Cooper for A Star Is Born. Christian Bale for Vice. Willem Dafoe for At Eternity's Gate. And Viggo Mortensen for Green Book.
Bradley Cooper deserved to win that award.
Yeah, he 100%. Maybe, yeah. 100%. Bradley Cooper, or I would have been happy with Christian Bale.
I'd have been happy with Bale as well.
Bale was
too.
Really good.
Let's not overlook the fact that Viggo Mortensen ate a pizza folded in half for his art.
He was good in that really middling movie.
Yes. Have you
he's
rewatched?
Yeah, he's great.
Stars Born.
Not in a while. No.
It was on the other day, and I stopped for a second, and I'm not kidding. I actually had a double take of like, wait, is that really Bradley Cooper?
Yeah.
And like, I'm like, this is a movie I've seen 10 times. We interviewed him for it. Like, that is one of the best performances. And not only did he direct it, stars, sings, plays. He was on stages at real concerts in between sets playing.
He did all the things Rami Malek didn't do.
But see, my argument on Rami Malek is that he embodied Freddie Mercury in terms of like, just the way he performed. I mean, I know the film is there's controversy about like what it did and what it cut out and things like that. I'm just talking about like,
and it's literal edits.
He literally to me became him in terms, at least on the Live Aid thing. Wow. I think that was unbelievable.
We will not litigate the Best Actor race in 2019. I believe that is.
Hey, we do that on our premium feed sometimes when we do the Oscars in review. So, hey.
And in the meantime,
we haven't done one of those in a while.
While you're caught up. Speaking about premium, check the description for this episode to find out how you can sign up for it. It gets you a free episode on Mondays. It gets you a newsletter and it gets you an ad-free version of the live show. Follow us online throughout the week for all of our insights into movies and pop culture at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and the show is at Real Blend. We'll be back next week with... I believe we're going to have the bros interviews, right? Judd Apatow, Nicholas Stoller.
Yes, sir. We also will have a bonus up on Wednesday featuring another interview, and it escapes me.
Nick and Judd as the bonus, it could be a bronus episode.
I believe we'll also have a Wednesday up, so we have a few things that are
funny.
Recorded.
That's we should do thinking. That just to be funny like that. And then
can we say that we also recorded with Andrew Dominik for Blonde.
Oh,
so
right. Yeah.
We're going to have that coming up soon, coming too. Up and soon he didn't do a lot of press for it. And that was a very interesting experience.
And also we just learned today that Judd Apatow apparently didn't do a lot of press yesterday.
Yeah.
Nope.
So that was kind of cool.
But he wanted to do Real Blend. They actually reached out to us for that one. So goes to show how special we are.
Yeah.
In the meantime.
Like my social media account.
That's what we need.
Jake's Takes. We'll be back with new episodes. So talk to you next week. The Fablemans.
Hockey
pads.
It won TIFF's Audience Award.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you. With professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.